My name is Steve Meister. I'm the president of the Maine chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I'm also a developmental behavioral pediatrician, the medical director of the Edmund Irvin Pediatric Center. I want to welcome everyone here to our annual spring conference. So it's 2018, and this is the end of my first 3 years as chapter president. We do 3 years as vice president, 3 years as president. And I often think of Jan Pelletier. She was our president before me. And what a great mentor she's been. She's such a light touch, yet she's a fierce advocate for children. So in Jan's honor, I thought to start our conference with a poem, because she always had a poem. A poem that fits Maine this time of year in places like Wolf's Neck, which is not far from here. So this is Spring Pools by Robert Frost. These pools that, though in forests, still reflect the total sky almost without defect, and like the flowers beside them, chill and shiver, will like the flowers beside them soon be gone. And yet, not out by any brook or river, but up by roots to bring dark foliage on. The trees that have it in their pent-up buds to darken nature and be summer woods, let them think twice before they use their powers to blot out and drink up and sweep away these flowery waters and these watery flowers from snow that melted only yesterday, or perhaps tomorrow. So welcome to our annual spring conference. Each year we work to present a conference that addresses the needs of children and families in Maine. Our program isn't just directed to pediatricians, but to a range of professionals caring for children and families from birth through independence. This year, we're bringing our Breakthrough Collaborative on ADHD, funded by the AAP and Pfizer, to our conference. Presentations will consider caring for the child with ADHD in schools, understanding the impact of ACEs and trauma on ADHD, and caring for the older adolescent at the college level. Friday, today, finishes with a keynote presentation by Dr. John Rady from Harvard Medical School to get us to think outside of the box about ways of helping kids of all ages with problems of executive function and impulse control. So not just ADHD, but autism and other similar challenges. Saturday, we continue with the life course approach to pediatrics with talks on substance-exposed infants, screening for substance abuse in teens, and our keynote speaker, Dr. Lucian Gonzalez, will talk on treatment options for teens affected by substance abuse. And we all know we have a huge problem with this in our state. Best practice concussion management, vision screening, and updates on ophthalmology and oral health will also be presented. Gordon Smith and Guy Cousins from the Maine Medical Association will help us better understand the laws covering confidentiality in schools and medical practice, so HIPAA and FERPA, and our Maine Medical Association Medical Professionals Health Program. And we conclude with Nancy Cronin. Where's Nancy? Director of the Maine Developmental Disabilities Council, and me, and the challenges of transition to adulthood for our patients with developmental disabilities, autism, and intellectual disabilities. So thank you all for coming. Amy?
Good morning. Aloha.
Aloha.
We've decided to be in Hawaii today. I'm Amy Belisle from Maine Quality Counts, and I'm one of the medical directors and also the pediatrician there. And we decided this was going to be our spring theme because there's been so much snow up here in Maine. I actually love Hawaii. I was stationed in Japan and got married in Hawaii, and it's a beautiful place, so it's a place of calm for me. So as Steve was saying, we actually are doing a combined conference today, and we're really delighted to have all of you. The first day, we're focusing on ADHD, and it's part of our CALM project, our collaborative ADHD learning in Maine work. So I'm just going to give you a quick overview of how this all ties together before we get started with our panel. And I want to thank our sponsors. We have some terrific sponsors for today's conference: Maine Health, From the First Tooth, Quality Counts, Eastern Maine Medical Center, and Plus Optics, and we really want to appreciate them and want you to stop by their booths and see them. For today's CME, nobody has any disclosures. We are really lucky to have funding, though, from the Pfizer Foundation. The Pfizer Foundation is independent grants for learning and change. It provides grant support for quality improvement projects. And Quality Counts has actually been lucky to have two previous funding opportunities from them around the opioid work and chronic pain. And now we have this project around ADHD. So because it is from the Pfizer Foundation, we do have to do Sunshine Act reporting for physicians who have some of their time paid for. And we just have to let you know that. They are funding part of this time. I also have to tell you, they don't pay for the food. Okay? Everyone got that? That's our disclosure. So CME is available, and we will be sending out a link afterwards for CME certificates of attendance. Jackie does have the sign-in list as you come in the door. Please sign in if you want CME. We need that for attendance. Here is our conference planning committee. It really takes a village to pull off these two-day meetings, and we're really thankful for everybody's help. If you're on the conference planning committee, could you just raise your hand? Not everybody is here today. Some people will be here tomorrow, but round of applause for them. It's a lot of work to pull this all together, so thank you. And I just want to give you a little bit of history back on the quality improvement work. I know many of you do quality improvement, and there's actually been a lot of quality improvement work happening in the state. John Fanberg's here. The Maine Youth Overweight Collaborative is something that got started many years ago. Many of you started with that work around healthy weight. The asthma program, I don't know if anyone is in the audience, they started to do a lot of quality improvement back in the 2000s. The state was very fortunate to get a CHIPR grant back in 2010. Steve Meister helped write that grant. It was a federal grant between Maine and Vermont. We were one of 17 states to get funding to start doing child health quality improvement work. And at the time, we actually were doing a project here with the AAP chapter, the National AAP on asthma. And that sort of got carried in, and we started really jump-started the quality improvement work. And we brought together what we call our Maine Child Health Improvement Partnership, so partners throughout the state that are working on these projects together. And we're trying to improve health not only at the practice level, but at the population level, and really working with our state and local partners to do that and our community partners. So we thank all of you. And we do have practices, and I'm going to talk about our ADHD project in a minute, that have been doing work all year around improving ADHD care. And just raise your hand if you're in one of those practices. We have Midcoast Pediatrics, Winthrop Pediatrics, EMMC's Family Medicine Center, SMHC's Biddeford Pediatrics, the Harry E. Davis Pediatric Center, yay. MMP in South Portland, John's over there. Franklin Pediatrics just joined the project recently. Is Franklin here in the back? Yay, all right. The Maine Parent Federation, Carrie's here. The school nurses and our health staff. There's been a lot of work with the school nurses working with us on this project. The M and Irvin Pediatric Center at Maine General, Steve and your group is around. And MMP Developmental Behavioral Pediatrics. And we've also gotten some assistance from Intermed, so we want to thank them very much. We are part of actually a five-state project with the Maine, the National AAP, and Suzanne Emmer. I don't know if Suzanne's here. There's Suzanne in the back. We haven't said hello this morning. So Suzanne is here. She's the director of the Division of Chapter Quality Improvement Activities for the National AAP. They have been leading this project with us over the past year, and it's going to wrap up sometime in the fall. So we really appreciate all their support. I want to thank all the school nurses. School nurses, raise your hand. You're like a force today. Thank you for coming. So school nurses are the force that keep all of this together and all this running. I've got four kids, and the school nurses, I want to express our gratitude to you. You keep everything running at school. I've got a child with a medical condition that requires her to go to the school nurse and talk to her every so often, and they keep us rolling, so thank you very much. And I want to thank all our main AAP members and all of our guests. Welcome to our exhibitors. You all should have your exhibitor bingo on your table or with you. You can win a raffle prize for that, and please go around and thank the exhibitors for joining us today. And as Steve went over the overview for the agenda, I just want to point out that there are two times when we are going to split up. So two times, once in the morning and once in the afternoon, where the folks who are working on the ADHD project are going to stay here, and the folks who are working on with the school nurses and with the other groups are going to move over to the carriage house. And we'll tell you. We are very fortunate to have Dr. John Rady here. Dr. Rady, we actually gave out your book at our fall conference on Spark. He has a new book called Go Wild, and he's going to give the afternoon keynote and also the morning keynote tomorrow. So we're really lucky to have him. And I'm just going to give you a brief keep calm and carry on what this calm project is all about so you know what we're doing. So we did get funding last year, actually on July 4th, to do a one-year project, a learning collaborative with primary care practices on improving ADHD care. We have 7 practices that have been working on this over the past year collecting data, and we're really trying to increase our practice compliance around ADHD diagnosis and management, providing educational handbooks out to parents, and that children who are diagnosed will get appropriate not only medical therapy but behavioral therapy. So we've been collecting this data, and Sue Buttstein is our coach on that, and we really appreciate her work, and Kayla Cole is our project manager. And we did this in partnership with the AAP. We did this application because we realized that there was a huge need in the state around ADHD. 1 in 10 children ages 4 to 17 are diagnosed with ADHD in 2010. We have 21,000 children ages 6 to 18 with ADHD. And our problem in the state of Maine is we only have 6 developmental behavioral pediatricians to help all the primary care folks and all the schools really manage this. So we realized that we really need to do more education. We needed to do more partnerships with our school nurses because we've got to learn how to manage this better. And there hasn't been a lot of training on ADHD recently. I remember when I was in Japan, I actually came to one of the Colby College conferences back in 2002 around ADHD. There hasn't been a lot of organized quality improvement, but there have been new guidelines, so we're working with folks on that. Just in terms of recognizing the team, Sue Buttstein is here as our quality improvement coach. Kayla Cole, maybe still checking people in. She's our project manager. Jackie Tyner helps organize and keep us all together. She's our administrative coordinator. And Dee Carey from the AAP, I think, is still out there. We've been very fortunate to have our experts, Steve Meister, Deb Hagler is in the front from the AAP, Carol Hubbard, who will be here this afternoon from Maine Medical Center, and Melissa Bulker-Kinley from InterMed has been working with us as a child psychiatrist on the project, and Carrie Woodcock in the Maine Parent Federation's team. And all of we do, we try to use the quality improvement model to improve our population-based outcomes. In some of our coaching sessions this morning, we're going to be going through the model for improvement. And we also, in your packets, if you haven't been doing the work with us over the last year, the AAP has a key driver diagram for ADHD. So it helps provide you with the diagrams and some of the interventions to improve ADHD care. So I pointed out it's in your packet. We're not going to go through it line by line, but it is available. And the AAP actually has a very long change package, which they've got a lot of ideas around how you can improve care, and we can make that available. Some of the work that we've been doing over the past year is working with school nurses and school health staff to improve care, and we're going to talk about some of that work on the panel this morning. Connecting parents with the positive parenting program, the Triple P program at the Edmund Irvin Center, and Steve's been working hard to make sure that there is funding and payment for that, not only in the Kennebec region, but different areas of the state. So we're really happy about that, and he'll touch on that this afternoon. Ross Green is a physician that's been talking with us about Lives in the Balance tools. We're actually working with him on some online videos for how to support providers around managing children with challenging behaviors, and Deb's been working on that. And we're working a lot with the Maine Parent Federation on how do we communicate better with families. We also just finished 2 online modules, which we'll show you this afternoon. So we now have online CME available, which Carol Hubbard and Melissa and Deb and Carrie have and Steve have done videotaped modules for us. So now they're available on demand. So if you missed the first meeting in October and you're really interested, they have those available for you. And as we kind of wrap up the day today, and we're sort of two-thirds of the way through our project, I just want to focus on some of the things that we have found have been very important as we do our quality improvement work, and I hope you'll sort of listen for these themes throughout the day as people start to share. So the things that seem to matter most as we do these projects is really the leadership matters, and I thank all of you for being leaders both at the practice and the community and the state level, because this is what drives our work. Our data and evaluation matter, and I know some of you hate doing the chart review, and it's so painful sometimes, but it is so important for us to see the trends and see how we're doing and to evaluate the projects. So that data really is very important. And our teams matter. So our teams are really important, and we find that we can't do this alone as primary care providers. We have to have a team around the family. That's where we bring the school nurses, the communities, the psychiatrists, everyone around the families, everyone who touches children. And our relationships matter. Our family stories matter, and I know many of you probably have a family story about someone that you're working with or someone within your family that has ADHD, and that's what really changes the work and really drives our work. Policy and systems change matter. And I'll just point out Dr. Chris Pizzullo is here from the Maine CDC / Maine Care. The chief health officer is in the corner. So the more that we work with the state and with our payers around this, it helps sustain the work moving forward. So that's really important. And then finally, fun matters. So we always like to have fun. Today's theme is Hawaii. If you're in the project with us, we have a few prizes. If you're not doing the project with us, we still have more prizes. So for the practices with us, if you write down a piece of paper and you can put in one of the bags what you're going to do to sustain your work, you will win a prize. The Keep Calm shirt, we'll pick one. You can nominate one person who's in your practice who's been sort of leading the work around the Calm project, and one person from the practice will get their tiki mug, which is the god of health. And we'll have another, we like theme songs, so if you have a good theme song that you want to talk about, you'll win the Keep Calm and Carry On mug. We also have exhibitor bingo. So once you complete it, there's a bag over there. We'll draw, and we have 6 raffle prizes at the end. Must be present. So keep calm and make it so. We're really delighted to have you today. I'm going to turn this over to Deb Hagler and the panel. But if you have questions about how this all works together, we'll be around today. But we're really delighted to have you join us. So thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. It's an honor to speak with everyone. And really, I'm going to speak about work that we've been doing in the Calm practice in Brunswick. And this work actually came from our data, because our practice was a well-oiled machine with some of the findings from the data, but in others, particularly in communicating with the schools, we were pretty flatlined. So, okay, I did not bring my teenage son with me, so I'm going to see if I can do this. So I have no relevant disclosures. So I just wanted to talk about how this was going to work. I'm going to just give a little bit of brief background about why we treat ADHD, the importance of the school, talk a little bit about resilience, some hiccups we encountered, and hopes, and then I'm going to turn it over and introduce my panel. So just a reminder of why we treat children with ADHD, and I'm going to do this quickly. About 30% of children with ADHD will repeat a grade. About 10% to 35% of kids will drop out of school. We know kids with ADHD have poor performances on standardized testing, and most kids with ADHD will have lower grades. They also have higher risks of injury. They have problems with social functioning. And I think one of my sweetest comments from a young adolescent who I treated, who was really insightful, said to me, "Dr. Hagler, my friendships are better after he got treated." And it just melted my heart, and I'll never forget him saying that. Youngsters who drive are more likely to get in automobile accidents and have license suspensions. There is an increased risk when you control for everything, all confounding factors. Kids with ADHD have a higher risk of suicide. And there's newer work out on the risk of obesity linked to ADHD and impulsive eating behaviors in kids with ADHD. So the other big thing is the risk of substance use disorder in children with ADHD. They have earlier onset of substance use experimentation. There's increased varieties of substances experimented with. And there are some similar biologic underpinnings with children with ADHD and substance use disorder. And there are some data to suggest that the timing of treatment for ADHD has an impact on substance use. Disorder. So, I've been listening to several intakes for adult patients coming into the substance use world at the Addiction Resource Center at ARC, and it's astounding how many adults with substance use disorder have comorbid ADHD. So, what we know about treatment, that treatment in the short term, and a lot of this data comes from the multimodal treatment study of ADHD, which was a large randomized control study done in the early 90s and reported out from the National Institute of Mental Health, which divided kids into 4 treatment groups, one that got medication alone, one that got medication and behavioral therapy, one that got nothing, and one that got community which meant just follow up with your doctor in the community, and showed that treatment really, in the short term, so over a 14-month period when they followed, treatment with medication in the academic setting and treatment with behavioral controls showed improvement on achievements and test scores. But over the long term, really, we don't have the data to suggest that there's a long-term effect on grades or grade retention. And this just was published, I think, in January of this year from the Dutch. And it wasn't a controlled trial, but they really tried hard to age match and really get their diagnosis tight. Long-term prospective age match study of kids with ADHD that were followed in a nice cohort to compare groups that got stimulants versus groups that didn't get stimulants over time, to look at the question whether developmentally some kids will grow out of their symptoms if they got treated with stimulants or not. And they were looking very specifically at academic symptoms, and they couldn't find any difference. So there were some problems with the study. The authors admitted they didn't control for co-founding features. They didn't control for other treatment modalities, such as behavioral therapy, which I think is a huge problem. But, you know, so treatment in the long haul, there's definitely issues, and I'll tell you why that's important in a second. So anyway, compliance with medication is from the MTA study, is relatively low, you'll see. And long-term studies, community-based, have huge compliance issues, and follow-up is random and iffy. And in the community setting, we're not as rigorous as particularly in the MTA study at titrating medications. So in the MTA study, which showed the best effect for medication, those kids were coming in monthly and seeing physicians to have their dose titrated. They were in really frequent contact with the schools. And that study did show the best effect. So what does that mean for me as a pediatrician? So in my mind, as a community pediatrician, that means are we following our kids close enough with these medications? So now those are all the reasons we treat, and a little bit about treatment and why I think it's really, really imperative for us to speak with our teammates in the sandbox. So this is another important reason that we really need to involve the school. Our parents are busy. So this is just a quick slide from the Department of Labor that shows in the early 70s only about half of mothers with children less than 18 were in the workforce, and now go up to 2013, it's closer to 70%. So a lot of moms with young children are in the workforce, and then this shows moms and dads. So both parents are really busy. So children spend on average 7 hours a day, 180 days a year. I didn't do the math. I can't do that in my head right now. Our diagnostic criteria ask for behaviors that are often best assessed at school. Symptoms have to be present in two or more settings, and symptoms need to interfere with functioning. And we often know if our treatment is working best by asking people in the schools. And a lot of times, although in the age of long-acting medication, you'll see when you hear from the panel, but in the age of long-acting medication, some kids don't need to take medication at school, but often we're adding an afternoon dose, so the medications are administered at school. So the schools are often collecting Vanderbilts for us, or not, in our case. They're helping provide education to parents around the diagnosis. They're supporting the family. They're helping coordinate and referring. I learned this language. So just like the schools aren't supposed to be diagnosing behavioral symptoms in the school, we're not supposed to be diagnosing what they need from the school. So part of our journey was lots of meetings with the school folks, and what we should be saying, they referral for services within the school. So things like referral for services and potentially IEP 504, further psychological testing and educational testing. And in the school, that educating families and other teachers about the importance of their input as we monitor and adjust medication. So the other thing I would say is the school is critical, and I'm going to steal a line from my friend Ross Green, that kids with ADHD are the most overcorrected, over-directed, and over-punished group of kids. And so they can be pretty beat up by the time they walk into the door. And So they have a huge role to play in that child's resilience. And I really liked this quote. Resilience is predicted by both the capacity of individuals and the capacity of their social and physical ecologies to facilitate their coping in culturally meaningful ways. So that then I don't have to use, but I'm going to now use it, Hillary Clinton's It Takes a Village. But that village is all of us. And that school and you all are critical in hugging that child and letting that child know that they're not a bad person, that they have some different needs and need some different direction or different educational skill set to meet the expectations of the school. So the school is critical, I think, in helping that child bounce back. So what can make this challenging? We all know that HIPAA makes this challenging, and for the schools on their side, FERPA can make this challenging. The other thing I learned as we sort of pushed through this journey were that there are so many departments within the school that may have their hands on a child with ADHD. So the nurses often are involved if there's medication, but sometimes the nurses don't even know if the child has a diagnosis of ADHD, if they're taking medication that's long-acting, but they're involved with special education and they have a whole program through the special education department. So that department may not be talking to the nurses. And then a lot of times the teachers aren't even aware unless they forget their meds that day. So there's a whole bunch of different hands in the school. And there's still a giant amount of stigma involved in the diagnosis. So families don't want to share the diagnosis. Some of the kids are really bothered by their diagnosis. Kids have varying knowledge or understanding of what it means to have ADHD. So we still have a lot to work on the idea of stigma. But I think there's a lot of hope. We got, you guys are all here on a Friday and the sun is shining in Maine, and so I think that's great hope. See, it was a toss-up. There's honesty. I think communication is getting better. And I'm going to show a little bit about the plan, and we're working hard in the Brunswick Bath area to sort of improve that. And our thought was to develop, we hear a lot about the hub and spoke in Vermont for opiate treatment, but the idea of really using our nurses as a hub. You guys are the medical knowledge in the school. You have a wealth to offer families and parents around this, and educate your fellow teachers in the school. So Lori here surveyed you guys, so and we had a pretty brisk response. So just you can see about half of our respondents are using the Vanderbilt in the school. This was a little unsettling. About a third are unsure of what we're talking about. So we have some education to do. The school nurses are not involved in that, and I think we're going to try and change that a little bit, at least in our area, to help us facilitate. Because we really, when we looked at our data for the COM project, we're getting very after our initial diagnosis of ADHD, we're barely using our Vanderbilts to titrate response to medication. So, and I'll tell you how we're going to do that. And is the school nurse able to communicate with the student's MD regarding progress in the school? And actually, this was encouraging. So about 63% of you said yes. So I thought that was great. Does the MD provide support for educators, school nurse? Okay, we got a little work to do here. So now, there's a copy of this in your packet. So one of our poorest data points was getting Vanderbilts back after we titrated medications. So we started a horse and pony show and went out to talk to schools. And one of the first things that Mary Booth in the Topsom area said was, you know what model really worked well was the AH action plan and the asthma action plan. Now I call it the ADHD action plan. But she said if we had something like that, that maybe parents could fill out and we could get around to all departments and have the team look at it for the schools, maybe that would be a place to start. So we went back to the national people at the AAP, and they said, well, we have something like that. And so that came back to us. And so we started to play with it. We showed it around the schools. We got input from their behavioral people, and we modified it back and forth. So this is our starting point. And we've been to several meetings with the folks in Brunswick and a few with the folks in Topsom. And in Brunswick, our plan is to start to trial this, hopefully at the beginning of the next school year, and ask the nurses to sort of act as our hub. And this will go back and forth, and to be determined. But we thought we had to start somewhere. And this is just something I threw in. So lots of people that have to give very pertinent and streamlined information use communication tools. So the military in high stress situations has very regimented tools of communication to give critical information. And this was something that I thought to help schools and physicians communicate back and forth if they have to speak to each other on the phone or if they want to give other information that's pertinent on a form to help them. This is from a psychiatry access project in Maryland. And I really liked, you know, just to help people think of critical information to pass on to as they see a child that may be having some safety or behavioral issues in the school. And it just, for psychiatrists that are really busy communicating, is the child safe? Are there specific behaviors that they're seeing in the school? Because the other critical thing that school nurses help us do is they help us identify comorbid conditions, which we know about 40% of these kids will have. What's the setting that they're having trouble? Is it only in Mrs. O'Leary's first period class that they're like, you know, throwing the chair across the room? I don't know. Have anything traumatic that the school knows happened at school? And are there other services that they have had or that they're aware of that the school knows to pass on to the physician? So I just thought this was a really sleek little tool. And now I'm going to introduce my wonderful panel, because they all have different insights on this. So I have Laura Hewitt, who has been a nurse for the last 11 years and has cared for many types of patients. She's been busy as an oncology nurse over at Parkview. And Linda Morris, who has served as an elementary school in Brunswick for the last 13 years. And she has been busy in my circle at Bowdoin Medical Group in Brunswick before that. And then Carrie Woodcock, who is the main executive director of the Maine Parent Federation, which is a nonprofit grant-funded agency that assists parents and children with special health care needs navigate the system of care. And I'm going to ask them to just comment a little bit about their experiences, and then there's those little Hilton pads of paper in front of you. Hopefully we'll have time for a few questions at the end. And if not, if you get them to us, we'll try to get people's questions answered. So thank you very much. And I'll let my panel take it away with their thoughts.
I'll go ahead and start first. Can I turn this on? Is it on? Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been a school nurse for 13 years. I'm at grades 2 through 5, just under 700 students. And a lot of students at that age level are just getting the diagnosis of ADHD, just starting medications. On any given day, I'm probably seeing 30 to 40 students with a mid-afternoon dose. So quite a few. I love the idea of the school nurse being the hub and the spoke, of being the child, the parent, the teacher, the healthcare providers. And I can see a fluid movement along each spoke. I've had teachers, very rarely do I see a Vanderbilt, other than when a teacher has one and says, what do I do with this? Who do I give it to? And I'm like, oh, that must have come from the child's primary care physician. They want you to fill it out. They must be starting medication. And okay, what do I do after? Well, you can give it to me. If you didn't get any further directions, I'll make sure it gets to the primary care provider. So we need to do a lot better with that. Then I've had a teacher come to me just this winter and say, I just filled this out 2 weeks ago. Why am I getting another one? Oh, this one says follow up. Oh, okay. So there again, a lot more education on the Vanderbilt. Just interestingly, this past Monday, I had a mother come in to my office and she brought a baggie and it had the prescription bottle and a note from her doctor and a note from her, please give this to my child. She has a fifth grade child that was just starting medication on Monday. And the teacher happened to walk by because the mailboxes are there. It's the beginning of the day. And she saw the parent and came in and said, oh, hi. And she goes, yes, he's starting medicine. And she said, now, I've told him you don't have to announce it to everybody. And then she turned to me and she said, can you make sure he gets this, you know, discreetly? And I said, well, actually, I said, what usually happens, the student comes in, I hear a lot of parents, I understand. But I said, it's amazing, the child looks at it differently. And I said, the child usually comes in and sees a whole line of other children getting medicine from me. And I said, they say, oh, you're on medicine? Do you take the blue pill too? And so, sure enough, this child came in at 12 o'clock. He stood there, I had a full house, like usual. And he looked around and he goes, I'm here for my medicine. And I thought, I wish I had that on video to show her. He wasn't so afraid to come and see me to take his medicine. And that just addresses that stigma. And I think we need to somehow do a better job of education along those lines as well. But that's my initial comment. I'll pass it on.
Okay. Hello. My name's Lori Hewitt. I have a little piece of, I feel, of this whole thing. I'm a mother of a child that has ADHD. He's 8 years old. He's about to be nine. He's in the third grade. I have been troubled with the stigma of ADHD throughout raising him. His birth mother had told me that she had ADHD, and I was positive that it must be situational, and I was going to give him a great, you know, supports, and he was going to have great clothes and great food and good nutrition, and that it wasn't going to happen, but it did. I resisted medication for a long time, an RN, yet I still titrated down when I was prescribed. He has struggled throughout school. He started in kindergarten, sitting most of the year out of the classroom because of his behavior. He was, when I saw that the picture on the slides of the little boy with all the dumbs, that's my son, who is amazing. He is the most caring, empathetic. He's a brilliant individual, and he's the kind of person that you would want to be next to you. I fear the way that our children are schooled and the way that us adults and us educators are uninformed about how ADHD works in the brain, that this can switch into, you know, oppositional defiant disorder. And he's not at that point yet, but he's starting to be like, what? You know, he's almost 9 years old. And so I recently have started being a school nurse in Lisbon, and I'm pretty excited to be a part of this and to be educating myself more and to be able to educate the educators in the school. It's interesting, the children that I see, I only see 7 students out of my 300 that get medicated in the middle of the day, because I'm in middle school, and I assume that there's a lot of them that are getting medicated in the morning out of 300 students. But I'm not involved in any of it. I just give the pills. I haven't seen a Vanderbilt at all. I've only been there for 5 months, though. It's funny that I know the children, and I know they're wonderful, the children that I do medicate. But I can see, I can see my kid in their eyes, and they know that they've done something that isn't socially acceptable at school. And they're hurting, you know. And I don't know that all of the educators, I feel like they need more, they need to know what ADHD is all about, and that it's not a matter of just, you know, you just have to control yourself and you know better than that, and because that's what we do. That's what we do. We all have to be able to sit, and we have basic three or four things that go into a 504, you know. That's it. We need some more ideas, and that's it.
Hi, I'm Carrie Woodcock. I'm the Executive Director for Maine Parent Federation, and I am also the parent of 2 children with disabilities. You saw my 11-year-old who has Down syndrome, and I would put my 13-year-old's picture up there, but he'd kill me. So he'd kill me to know that I'm talking about him today, but he has ADHD and dyslexia. I have navigated the systems of care for both of my children, which are very... there are many systems of care. So we're sitting here talking today about medical and sort of melding the medical with the school world. It's important to remember that the parents that you're working with on a daily basis are navigating many, many, many systems of care. So, and most of us have more than one child at home. And in my case, I have 2 children who require a lot of advocating on my behalf, and 2 very different types of advocating. Obviously, my daughter with Down syndrome, it's easy to get her diagnosis, it's easy to get her IEP. I need to make sure that they're following through. It took me 2.5 years for me to get my son's IEP. for him to get assistance at school with reading and with his ADHD. And since then, we've actually transitioned to a 504 plan. What I've done for Noah is I've brought him in on advocating for himself. It's very important for me to teach the skills of self-advocating. And I think it's important to teach parents how important it is to teach the skills of self-advocating. And really, it starts with parents. A lot of the work that we do at Maine Parent Federation is try to educate parents on how to assertively advocate for your child's needs, no matter what system of care that you're navigating. And there's a big difference between being passive, being aggressive, and being assertive. On the school side, parents oftentimes get labeled as aggressive because they're desperately trying to get their child's needs met, and what they're seeing at home and what you're seeing at school are two very different kids. And so they're doing the best they can. We try to educate them on, let's teach you how to be assertive. And the best way to do that is to provide data to whoever you're working with on what you're seeing at home and getting your top three needs met. Instead of coming in with a list of 1,000 needs, because I don't know, I'm a mom and I want everything for my child, but I also realize that if I go into a school system or if I go into a doctor's office, if I go to my Section 28 workers and am asking for 1,000 things, the opportunity for me to get any of those needs met are gonna get dropped pretty low. So I try to pick the top three for my child, and we teach parents to try to pick their top three and work with any system of care to get those top three needs met. What we like to tell professionals who are working with these parents is please be aware that we are the vehicle that gets our child's needs met. And so as the vehicle, I'm navigating the system of care for the school district. I'm navigating the system of care for any pediatrician visit. And there are many medical needs. So there are a lot of specialists that we're having to take our children to. And then there are state services, for example, Section 28. Or Section 21 or 29 as you get up into adult services. Those are just four examples. On a daily basis, 5 out of 5 days a week, I have an appointment for my daughter after school. Whether it be a specialist appointment, whether it be a medical appointment, whether it be some sort of therapy we're getting after school. That doesn't include my son's regular activities that I'm trying to keep normal for him as well. So I'm going 5 out of 5 days a week and working a full-time job. My time is very limited, and it's not that I don't want to sit and listen, and it's not that I don't want to give my child that medication, or I don't want to make it to that appointment, but we're pulled in 1,000 different directions, and we really, really want to have our children's needs met, but we need some guidance in helping to navigate those systems of care and how to do it in an assertive manner. And Maine Parent Federation can assist you guys with helping your families. All of our services that we offer parents are free. They don't have to pay for anything. There's no qualifying circumstances. They don't need Section 28. They don't need a specific health insurance. So we offer many different trainings, but we also offer one-to-one peer support, and we offer information specialists that are available to parents and professionals to help answer questions and help navigate all the different systems of care so that we're teaching our parents how to be able to navigate all the systems and work with you. I can guarantee you if you did that same survey with parents about assessments, they're going to have no idea what it was. You're going to get less of response than you did from nurses. We have so many assessments that we deal with for our children on a regular basis that taking the time to explain how important it is with these parents will help get that information back to you. So in my module, I talked a lot about empathy and providing a little bit more time with parents. If you know you have a parent who has a child with some more special health care needs, if you're able to schedule a little bit more time into an appointment that you have coming up, that makes all the difference in the world, and knowing that you care and helping them navigate that system of care. So essentially what we're all here for is our children's needs get met in the long run.
So we have a few minutes for questions. I don't know if anybody has any. So, John.
With the Maine Parent Federation, how consistent is the care across, how consistent are the responses or help phone for any one person calls? Is there quality control that goes on? I guess some of the nurse people may answer the phone and respond.
Yeah, so our information specialists are available 8:30 to 4:30, Monday through Friday, and there isn't a person who doesn't, like if you call, if a parent calls and has a question, we get back to you within 24 hours period of time. Our Family Support Navigator program is our one-to-one peer support. And so when a parent calls into our offices and is looking for more specific navigation of systems of care, we'll refer them to our Family Support Navigator program.
and that offers 10 hours of direct support to that family, whether it be in-person support, over the phone, email, whatever that family is comfortable with. Our motto is we meet the parent where they're at, and we take them as far as they're willing to go. That being said, we're not like case management, so we don't close a case on a parent without knowing that they're comfortable and their needs have been met.
I guess my question, is it a volunteer organization or is it oversight?
So we have 7 employees, full-time employees or full-time equivalent employees, and our family support navigators are parents who get a stipend from us, and they've had lived experience. And all of our staff members have lived experience. We all have children at home with special health care needs.
Yep. Steve?
So I have a child, and the child has an IEP, and it's all spelled out, and I know what services the child's supposed to get. I know what it's based on, because I can see the cognitive scores and the school testing that's been done, and then I see the follow-up over time, where the goals met, et cetera. Then I get a 504 plan, and it's, really different. So, I mean, I know it is, but can you describe it a little bit, and how helpful is it?
So an IEP, or an individual education program, is the individualized plan for a child in their special education. What can be on that plan are specific educational and social and emotional goals. I think what's really important and what's missed a lot of times is parents think that it's just for academic goals, and it's not. The social emotional piece on that IEP is important, especially for these kids with ADHD. So there are two very different pieces that can go into an IEP plan. And then when they hit ninth grade right now, age 14 or ninth grade, there's a third part of the plan called the transition plan, which helps drive goals for post-secondary education and employment goals. So there ends up being 3 parts of an IEP plan. It identifies their special education program or plan, so that's any specific education instruction that they get throughout the course of the day. That does not mean that they have to go to a resource room. It means that they can receive push-in. And what I mean with push-in is they get instruction in a classroom from a special education teacher within the mainstream classroom, if that's the appropriate environment. And oftentimes we hear LRE thrown around, which is least restrictive environment, and that's basically the best spot for that child to learn at any given point in a day. It also can outline accommodations for that child, which is what can also go on a 504 plan, and it can outline any sort of therapies that a child gets. So PT, OT, or speech are the 3 of the most common therapies that you'll see within an educational setting. When a child is done with their specific specialized instruction, so for example, my son no longer needed specific reading instruction anymore within the middle school level, and so we did a 504 plan and transitioned out of the IEP because he didn't need the specified instruction he was getting before. What that means, and 504 is covered under the American with Disabilities Act, so it's not special education, it's not something just specific to school districts. We think of it that way because we get a 504 plan and a piece of paper from the school system that outlines the accommodations, but when they go out into the real world, they're covered under the ADA and the 504 plan in the real world too. So that's why it's really important to teach the kids the ability to self-advocate, because when they go out into the real world and into a post-secondary education environment or employment environment, that they need to self-advocate and ask for those accommodations within those settings. A lot of times what we'll see on a 504 plan are different accommodations for things like specific seating or standardized testing, the ability to have a scribe, the ability to use any sort of assistive technology can go on a 504 plan, which is really important for kids with ADHD as well. Extended time, homework accommodations are huge for these kids. I don't know about you guys, but my kid can't do homework at home. So we have extra time written into his plan so he gets it done at school. So those are the types of things. They're more accommodation type things that you see in a 504, but the really important part is everybody's covered under 504 when you leave school, and you don't have to have a specific piece of paper to take to your employment. But the important part is working with that student on being able to advocate for those accommodations and how to ask for them, because yes, these kids are really sensitive to their needs. And so making sure that they have the technology. So my son, for example, emails his teachers when he needs extra time so that he doesn't have to get up in front of the class and ask for extra time or homework. So it's very individualized to each kid, just like an IEP would be. And yeah, we need to get more creative with 504s. It's, you know, we see the same things over and over again on those plans, and getting more creative and thinking outside the box is very helpful. Is that?
That's exactly. What is the Section 28?
Oh, so Section 28 is in home supports provided through the state of Maine, and you need Medicare in order to take care of those. So you'll see behavioral health professionals come into homes and work with children. Okay. So in home supports with parents. Medicare or Katie Beckett gets you qualified, and we help parents navigate that as well.
Thank you.
John.
Hi, John. First, thanks to the panel for being involved with these kids. It's vitally important. We appreciate that. Two questions. One for the representative for the Maine Parent Federation. How involved you and your team do you get with and in the schools?
We're on the back of every IEP. So if you flip to the back page of an IEP, it'll list Maine Parent Federation as a resource, and that's because we're the Parent Information Center for the state of Maine through the Office of Special Education Programs in Washington, D.C. So we get very involved with schools, and that drives probably about 85% of the phone calls that we get. Sue Fairfield, she's sitting in the back, but she's manning our table. She's one of our information specialists. We have a table in the other room, and she can talk to you a little bit about, she answers a lot of our phones, but I would say about 85% of our phone calls come from parents having issues with school districts. And once we go into a school district, we're not advocates. We're not legal advocates, and we're not lawyers. It's very important for us to have the reputation that we're going to work with schools and help educate parents. And so we're usually welcome into districts. And in fact, we do 3 resource fairs across the state of Maine on a yearly basis, and we usually do them within a school district. It's free space, but they like to have us come in and work with parents. So our reputation with the DOE is a pretty positive one. I know Jane Breton very well. I sit in the IDEA Part B Advisory Council up in Augusta as well. We just worked with DOE on putting out an advocacy brochure just for parents to outline what's available for them for advocacy. And they came to us and asked us to help them. So we have a pretty good relationship. And independently with school districts, we try to make sure that we're welcome into their schools. We don't want to have an aggressive relationship at all with the district.
And so thank you. The second question for the school nurses is, the Vanderbilt to the teacher is the paradigm I typically use. Mm-hmm. And you're proposing a shift to the nurses. Most of my patients, they know their teacher. So I send the Vanderbilt specifically to the teacher. They don't know the nurses because they haven't been to your office yet. They're not getting that medication.
Right.
So how do you propose shifting that paradigm?
Well, I think we're going to pilot it in Brunswick this fall, and we're going to roll it out and see how it works. But
so, what our form allows is there's a consent between the school and the physician, so we get around HIPAA and FERPA. And if what happens is those med checks come up really quickly, and so what we propose is when we tell the parents we want to check in and titrate the dose, our Vanderbilts are on our website, so we can tell the school nurse or contact the school nurse and just have her go buzz the teacher, pull down the form from our website. The teacher can fill it out. She can take it right from them and fax it back. So a lot of times our parents will forget, or they won't be in for a website. Okay, our time is up. But they won't be – we won't see the parents when they're due for their med check or right away when they've adjusted it. So if we get that form signed and there's bilateral consent, we can touch base with the school nurse. She can run down to the teacher, grab the teacher, have them fill it out right after we've adjusted, and pull it back. The idea at the beginning of the year is to have mutual consent and then let her sort of run back and forth, not have the parent go back right after a med adjustment. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you see them, right? You see them, you adjust their med, and then you may touch base with them over the phone or not see them again for a while, but we can do it quicker if we have the school nurse as our sort of hub right then and there, and consent pre-signed. We're going to see how it works. It's a work in progress.
I'm a school nurse, it's been 40 plus years. And I tell my teachers at the beginning of the year when we have our 2 days of orientation, basically, any forms come to me. I make sure that sometimes I make extra copies because in the classroom setting, you get controlled, you want to see how they're doing in the fine arts, such as gym, music, or one-on-one if they get reading supports and things like that. So I send out copies. This also gives you different times of the day because there's time schedule on there, what time they're being assessed.
so you know if your med is on board or waning, and make copies to special ed. One goes in their health record, and I get it back to their health care provider. And they have I give them about a week, so before their next meeting. So that's the way I work it, and it's been working real well. So the teacher gets handed one from a parent, it comes right to me.
That's great. Okay, thank you. I want to thank my panel. I have little gifties. Thank you so much, you guys. So, Carrie.